When you wonder, you're learning Mr. Rogers' enduring lessons for raising creative, curious, caring kids. By Greg Bear and Ryan Rydowski, forward by Joanne Rogers. Chapter 6, Such a Good Feeling, Connection. There are more important things to do than having fun, King Friday thunders, casting a glare from the balcony. He's been angry, no, wounded, for several episodes now, baffled by make-believe denizens. First came their frivolous hats. His wife, Queen Sarah Saturday, had declared a hat day for no other reason except that wearing hats can be fun. Worse, she held a whole hat party at the castle. I find my fun in other things than hats, the king had said indignantly. Then came soccer, the simple, silly game that Prince Tuesday had taken to playing. Lately, there'd been talk of forming a team, talk that appalls our solitary king. And now, to Friday's great vexation, his subjects have gathered near the castle to sing each other a song, something about going around a mulberry bush. There's Lady Aberlin and Bob Dog and Handyman Negri and others joining hands and spinning around in a circle. They're smiling, laughing, jumping around without including him, their benevolent monarch, who makes their decisions and issues their rules and even, on occasion, treats them to sounds from his bass violin. Well, no more. King Friday the 13th had finally had it with fun. For him, fun means making pronouncements. Long ones, he says, when short ones would do. He leans over the balcony to make a pronouncement now. But before he can speak, one of his subjects, the earnest, ever-excitable Bob Dog, looks up and sees him. And Bob Dog asks an innocent question. Would you like to play Here We Go Round the Mulberry Bush, King Friday? We have lots of room. The canine's question stuns the moody sovereign. King Friday the 13th isn't one to receive invitations. If anything, he's more likely to stop fun and games than he is to join in himself. Friday, perhaps for the first time, doesn't know what to say. I don't think, does it take a great deal of expertise? Oh, try it, King Friday, says Handyman Negri. We'll be glad to show you how, barks Bob Dog. King Friday looks around at his porch, which suddenly strikes him as lonely. He decides to join his subjects after all, and as they dance and sing and spin around the make-believe mulberry bush, something changes in the king. He starts to have, he won't call it fun, but pleasant moments, perhaps. He lets down his royal guard, if only for a song with the people and puppets who, in another kind of life, he might have counted as friends. And then his voice begins to break. King Friday starts to tell them something, something he's never told anyone else. In the spring of 2020, as a deadly coronavirus spread across the planet and kept countless people sheltered in place at home, a curious phenomenon surfaced in the nightly news. Around the world, balconies and front porches and rooftops suddenly became stages. In Italy, quarantined residents sang operas from their windows and staged complicated choreographed dances that included whole apartment buildings. In the United States, musicians stepped to their front porches with trumpets, guitars, and yes, even bass violins. And in Pittsburgh, neighbors came out to sing, "What else? Won't you be my neighbor?" The outbreak of COVID-19 revealed a few things about humanity. Perhaps the most poignant, however, was the extent to which it reminded us of our most basic human need, the need for connection. No matter how solitary or self-reliant we are, we all require relationships with other people. In fact, a growing body of research suggests that the need for human connection is more than a warm, nice-to-have feeling. It is biological imperative. Quite simply, writes Dr. Vivek Murthy, the former Surgeon General and author of Together, The Healing Power of Human Connection in a Sometimes Lonely World, human relationship is essential to our well-being as food and water. Our very survival depends on it. In the 1940s, Austrian psychologist Renee Spitz followed two groups of children from infancy through the first few years of their lives. The first group grew up in an orphanage, one that, like many in the aftermath of World War II, was overcrowded and under-resourced. The nurses did what they could, caring for up to seven infants at once, but the shortage of adults meant the babies spent most of their time alone in their cribs. Sheets hung to prevent the spread of disease meant they couldn't even see their infant neighbors. The second group was raised in a prison nursery where their incarcerated mothers were at least allowed to visit with and hold them throughout the day. Although the infants' development began on the same trajectory, differences emerged as the two groups approached their first birthdays. Babies who'd been raised in the orphanage appeared less curious and less playful than their peers in the prison. They were also less physically healthy, even though the orphanage was far more sanitary. Over time, the difference between the two groups grew steadily starker. The children raised by their mothers in prison learned to walk and talk in ways comparable to their peers on the outside. After 5 years, all were alive and healthy. Among the kids who'd been raised in the orphanage, however, only a few could walk or talk. Most knew just a handful of words, and although all 91 children had been well cared for physically, within 2 years, 34 had died. The high mortality, Spitz wrote, is but the most extreme consequence of the general decline, both physical and psychological, which is shown by children completely starved of emotional interchange. Spitz's work helped show the world just how essential human connection can be. Not long afterwards, the American psychologist Harry Harlow removed any doubt that remained. In a series of cruel experiments that remain controversial, Harlow separated baby rhesus monkeys from their mothers to study the effects of isolation. In one instance, he raised monkeys in solitary confinement for several months or a year, an experiment that wrought bizarre behavior and seemingly permanent psychological damage. The monkeys screamed, tore their hair out, bit themselves, and generally came undone. In another, Harlow gave baby monkeys a choice between two artificial mothers. The first, made of wire, contained bottles of milk that the monkeys could use to feed themselves. The second, made of cloth, contained no food at all, and yet the baby monkeys overwhelmingly preferred it. The infants chose, in other words, the surrogate who brought them comfort over the one who gave them food. Harlow's findings suggest an evolutionary component to our human need for connection. Our early ancestors, experts say, banded together to protect themselves from starvation and attack. Raising children in hostile, unpredictable environments really did take a village, and before that, it took a tribe. Early humans who could bond with potential helpers lived longer and reproduced more, passing their wiring down to us. Even today, when we're faced with isolation, our bodies react like we're alone on the savanna, ancient predators prowling in the grass. For most of human history, our safety depended on our security within the group. As a result, we're almost always thinking about other people. Remember your brain's default mode network from chapter 2, that place you go when you're bored and running on autopilot? It's programmed, scientists say, to prepare you to connect with others. Whether you realize it or not, you're thinking about other people even when you're not thinking at all. You've been doing this since you were 2 weeks old, and you'll do it for the rest of your days. Humans are that social. When we feel secure within a group, we call the feeling belonging. Belonging is the sense that we're safe to be ourselves without the risk of exclusion. It's psychological safety on steroids, the feeling that you're part of an in-group. Belonging has long been linked to psychological and even physical benefits, from a sense of serenity and increased well-being to better health and a longer life. In an ideal world, we'd belong wherever we went and bond with whoever we met, forming close, nurturing relationships across every line of difference. But as we're constantly reminded, we're a long way from that world. Even before the COVID-19 pandemic, public health experts had been sounding the alarm about a rise in deaths of despair. Deaths due to suicide, alcoholism, drug addiction, and more, all of which have roots in a lack of belonging. Then, of course, there are the man-made pandemics of racism, sexism, xenophobia, and political toxicity, all of which thrive on disconnection and exclusion. Belonging may be a fundamental need, human need, but it's by no means a guaranteed part of our existence, and we suffer tremendously in its absence. In some ways, we're victims of our own design. It is our DNA to want to bond deeply with some people and not others, writes Howard J. Ross, author of Our Search for Belonging, How Our Need to Connect is Tearing Us Apart. As a species, we've spent most of our time in tribes, small groups of about 150 people at most, nearly all of whom were exactly like ourselves. Survival was mostly a matter of knowing who was a threat and who wasn't, who was in and who was out. This tendency towards tribalism might even account for language. According to one theory, humans learned to talk not so that we could cooperate or discuss our plans for hunting big game, but so we could whisper behind each other's backs. It's not enough for men and women to know the whereabouts of lions and bison, explains Yuval Noah Harari in his epic account of our species, Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind. It's much more important for them to know who is in their band, hates whom, who is sleeping with whom, who is honest and who is a cheat. Knowing who could be trusted and who couldn't gave early humans a huge advantage, allowing tribes to expand and setting the stage for society as we know it. The gossip theory might sound like a joke, Harari admits, but numerous studies support it. Even today, the vast majority of human communication, whether in the form of emails, phone calls, or newspaper columns, is gossip. For better and for worse, we've inherited our ancestors' needs to prejudge others as friends or foes. On one hand, this means it's generally pretty easy to connect with people who strike us as similar to ourselves, whether in terms of appearance, attitudes, or political beliefs. When people discuss the bliss of finding their tribe, they're tapping something ancient and real. On the other hand, humans have a long history of avoiding, disliking, and even annihilating dissimilar others. We've been quick to make others the targets of our anger and our insecurity and our ignorance, often with disastrous results. This us versus them mentality appears in humans at a shockingly early age. University of Toronto professor Kang Lee has found evidence of racial bias among six-month-olds when babies begin to associate faces from their own race with happy music and faces from other races with sad music. Another researcher, J. Kylie Hamlin of the University of British Columbia, asked 9-month-old and 14-month-olds to choose which food they liked best, graham crackers or green beans. The infants then watched a series of puppets shows in which characters declared their like or dislike for the same two foods. The 14-month-olds not only preferred characters who had similar tastes, Hamlin found they also preferred characters who harmed puppets with different tastes. Even the 9-month-olds preferred characters who harmed dissimilar others. Babies, it seems, like to see their snack time rivals punished. This isn't to say that kids are born spiteful. Far from it. As we've already discussed, very young children also show altruism. The point is that we're wired for both connection and cruelty, and the ways we deploy them often depend on who we see as in and who we see as out. In children, those distinctions are fairly flexible, though they tend to grow more rigid with age. When children reach adolescence, for example, their brains prioritize their peers and the in-group, which is why teens become so famously self-conscious and concerned with popularity. While humans' ability to sort for threats has undoubtedly helped us survive, our tribalism also limits us. When we feel threatened, we sometimes revert to counterproductive, even harmful instincts. We withdraw or lash out, especially if we've learned to reach out, or if reaching out has proven dangerous, or especially if we haven't learned to reach out, or if reaching out has proven dangerous. Yet, we've yet to develop reliable ways of connecting across distances, whether we measure those distances in miles, years, appearances, bank accounts, or other forms of invented allegiance. According to the late author Audre Lorde, we have all been programmed to respond to the human differences between us with fear and loathing, and to handle that difference in one of three ways: ignore it, And if that is not possible, copy it if we think it is dominant, or destroy it if we think it is subordinate. But we have no patterns for relating across our human differences as equals. As a result, those differences have been misnamed and misused in the service of separation and confusion. This separation spills over into everyday headlines. We see it in hate crimes and wars. It spills over, too, into everyday lives, in racism, brutality, and indifference. Tribalism may have helped build our modern society, but somewhere along the line, it stopped serving us. We're too interconnected, too dependent on one another. Even if you wanted to avoid the other, the person from the other country, the other race, the other snack food preference, today's world makes doing so impossible. To discover and sustain a sense of belonging, then we have to forgive even. We have to forge it even beyond our tribes. We have to build new connections, new relationships, and new spaces to meet each other as humans. We have to build a neighborhood. Exclusion hurts, literally. This is quite difficult for me to talk about, says the emotional King Friday, his voice shaky and hesitant. Today, he confesses, was his first time going around a mulberry bush. Before now, he'd never been invited. Uncle Friday, Lady Aberlin cries, I didn't know that. It's true. When I was a young prince, I was not very fine at playing games, explains the sullen king. So when it came time for people to choose their teams, nobody ever... He trails off, doing his best to collect himself. So much of King Friday the 13th suddenly makes sense. His mood, his obstinance, his drastic changes of heart. It had all seemed so arbitrary before. But now, as he tries not to weep before his make-believe subjects, it's clear that King Friday's in pain. Sometimes it makes people sad when nobody chooses them, he says. His subjects nod. That's for sure, says Bob Dog, an outsized canine from Westwood. Bob Dog knows what it's like to be the other, to feel unwanted by a team. I was all paws, he says. I really didn't play very well. You either, King Friday asks. Me either, Bob Dog responds. In the distance, a piano plays a sorrowful chord. A lack of belonging hurts, although it's something that most of us already know. Admitting it isn't easy, as King Friday would tell you. We need human connection, like we need water and food. Yet hunger and thirst feel much more acceptable to acknowledge and talk about than loneliness, writes Dr. Murthy. To combat this silencing effect, then, we need to more deeply appreciate the relationship between loneliness, social connection, and physical and emotional health. Thanks to advances in science, that relationship has grown increasingly clear. Loneliness and exclusion, research says, inflict more than sad feelings. They inflict our decisions, diminish our cognitive capabilities, and keep us from thriving in every conceivable way. Students from schools with high rates of bullying tend to do worse on standardized tests than kids in kinder, more inclusive classrooms. Likewise, a study in New York City found that when neighborhoods gentrified, the low-income kids who were born there faced higher rates of anxiety and depression. According to one researcher, the changes wrought by a sudden influx of wealth makes original residents feel they no longer belong in those neighborhoods, which makes kids feel uncomfortable and anxious. That is something to watch out for. It's not just kids. Adults, too, feel the powerful effects that stem from a lack of belonging. In 2002, psychologists Jean Twang, Roy Baumeister, and Christopher Nuss gave 40 college students a fake personality test, randomly assigning them to three groups based on their supposed results. The first group, the future belonging group, was told they'd have rewarding, caring relationships throughout their lives. The second group, the future alone group, was told that their friendships would fade, their marriages would end, and they'd likely spend most of their lives alone. The third group wasn't told anything about relationships. Instead, they learned they'd be prone to physical accidents, such as car crashes. The researchers then gave all three groups a timed IQ test. The Future Alone group bombed it, scoring significantly worse than the other two. In fact, the Future Alone group was the only group that seemed affected at all. Even the accident-prone group scored as well as the Future Belongers. The researchers concluded that it wasn't bad news in general that had produced a drop in test score, but rather the prospect of social exclusion. When confronted with thoughts of an imagined life alone, students' stress response systems kicked in, draining their ability to think and reason with clarity. Down to our neurobiological core, we're terrified of not belonging, and for good reason. Over time, chronic exclusion invites depression, anxiety, and disease, making us sicker, sadder, and lonelier. Left unchecked, loneliness becomes a vicious cycle in which we push others away and avoid the very connections we crave. You imagine that you're a misfit, writes Dr. Murphy. You worry that you'll feel lonely even when you're with people, and most destructive of all, you question your self-worth, thinking that there might be something truly wrong with you that's causing this pain. Even a slight rejection can start us down this path. In 1983, Professor Kip Williams of Purdue University was relaxing in a park when a rogue frisbee struck him in the back. He turned around and threw it to the two strangers behind him. To the profound surprise, they threw it back to him again, and soon a spirited, spontaneous game of catch was underway among Williams and his new friends. Unfortunately, it didn't last. What happened next would change not only the professor's own life, but also our scientific understanding of what happens when we feel left out. For no apparent reason, the two original players started throwing the frisbee only to each other, Williams recalled. Insulted, no wounded, Williams went back to playing with his dog, shocked by how felt bad he felt. He was sad, embarrassed, and a bit angry, despite the fact that he'd never met his two ex-friends. He wondered what he'd done to deserve their scorn. The incident hurt Williams deeply, but it also planted a seed. Later in his career, Williams and his colleague developed Cyberball, a computer game in which players toss a ball back and forth between digital avatars. In an experiment, they recruited more than 1,000 participants from all over the world, telling them the 5-minute game would prime their mental visualization skills for use in a later task. They also told players that the avatars in the game represented real people who were playing in separate rooms, people who really didn't actually exist. In reality, each participant played against a computer. After a few friendly games, the computer would isolate the player to varying degrees. Some players would get the ball for half the remaining throws, some for a third, and some for a sixth. Some never got the ball again, at all. The results were astounding, wrote Williams and his colleagues. Although participants were playing a game with a disc or ball that did not actually exist and with fictitious other people whom they did not know and whom they did not expect to meet, they actually cared about the extent to which they were included. The more players were ostracized, the lower their levels of belonging and self-esteem, and the less they considered their very existence to be meaningful. This held true even when participants learned that the other players weren't real. In other words, even when they knew that their exclusion was a ruse, one concocted by nothing more than a computer code, they still felt just as hurt. In another study, Williams and his colleagues convinced participants that the other players were people they disagreed with, such as people with opposing politics, or people they downright hated, such as members of the Ku Klux Klan. It didn't matter. Even when playing with people they openly despised, ostracized participants reported similarly low levels of belonging, self-esteem, control, and meaningful existence, and similarly lower mood levels as well. In another version of the game called Cyberbomb, participants were blown up and eliminated altogether. Even that didn't hurt as badly as being rejected. It's long been known, of course, that people sometimes respond to rejection by lashing out. The child who is not embraced by the village, a popular proverb warns, will burn it down to feel its warmth. With this in mind, University of Kentucky psychologist C. Nathan DeWall and his colleagues designed a different cyberball experiment, one in which participants who'd been ostracized could act aggressively towards innocent bystanders. Sure enough, the more participants felt ostracized, the more they showed signs of aggression. But here's the good news. Aggressiveness decreases among people who felt included by at least one player. Feeling accepted by even a single person, it turns out, can make us less lonely and hostile, even if that person only exists on a screen. We need to know that we're worth being proud of. The trolley returns for make-believe, and Mr. Rogers waits for us as usual. But here is his bright, comfortable living room. He doesn't look so happy. On the contrary, he looks downright depressed. King Friday and Bob Dog were remembering times when people were playing a game and didn't want them to play, says Rogers. That made the king and Bob Dog really sad. Rogers pauses, letting his words linger in the white space. He casts his glance downward, and it's suddenly clear where King Friday's story had come from. The music stops, the neighborhood set goes quiet. I remember a time when I wasn't too good at playing basketball, says Rogers, and nobody wanted me on their team. If anything characterized Fred Rogers' childhood, it was the feeling of not fitting in. Though his material needs were more than met, Freddie still struggled. His peers had little use for the chubby, sickly, sensitive rich kid. With no one to sit with during lunches at school, Freddie went home to play by himself. Once, a group of bullies chased him through La Trobe, calling him Fat Freddie and threatening to pummel him. Even at home, he sometimes felt like he didn't fit in. When his parents held their huge annual Christmas party, Freddie secluded himself in his room, hearing the music and laughter as it seeped up the stairs. While our go-to guidance for children like Freddie is often to tell them to ignore other people's opinions, such advice is futile, as the cyberball studies makes clear. Worse, it can make kids feel like their pain means something is wrong with them. Instead, writes Dr. Murthy, kids who feel left out need to be reminded of the people who do value and accept them, whether they be in a different group of friends, a club or community group, or their favorite family members. It's a lesson Rogers himself learned at an early age. As the target of bullies, the advice I got from the grown-ups was just let on you don't care. Then nobody will bother you, he recalled. Of course, it didn't work. Rogers did care, and pretending otherwise only made things worse. So he sought solace in the few people who seemed to accept him, particularly his mother and his maternal grandfather. Fred McFeely liked to tell him, I like you just the way you are, says Maxwell King. Lots of people read that and think, oh, he was just trying to make the boy feel good. But that's not true. McFeely was trying to open up the world to him. He knew how shy and introverted Fred Rogers was. He wanted to give Rogers the confidence to explore the world and to learn about himself. He wanted to let Rogers know that he was appreciated, that he was enough. Relationships like these help Rogers weather the storms of his childhood. And as he grew older, he sought a sense of belonging in more and more places. After failing to find it at Dartmouth, he flew to Florida to visit Rollins College, which had a superior music program that had been recommended by a mentor. There, a group of students he'd never even met came to the airport to greet him, a gesture that must have seemed extraordinary to Rogers after so many years of rejection. We were hanging out the window of the car when he came out, recalls one of those students, Joanne Bird. We grabbed him and took him right with us and made him one of us. Rogers had clearly found what he was looking for. He transferred to Rollins at once, and a few years later, Joanne Bird became Joanne Rogers. Rogers tried to recreate that feeling of belonging when he came to Studio A. The neighborhood, he once told author Jean Marie Leskis, was less a television program than an atmosphere, one that allows people to be comfortable enough to be who they are. That atmosphere permeates every frame, from the opening message of acceptance, I have always wanted a neighbor just like you, to the closing promise of continued connection tomorrow. I'll be back when the day is new, and I'll have more ideas for you, and you'll have things you'll want to talk about. I will too. Wherever he goes, Rogers introduces each new person to his television neighbor, the viewer. At every point, notes the children's writer, Roderick Townley, the child sitting at home is included, acknowledged, and treated as a collaborator. The neighborhood's atmosphere informs even the subtler aspects of the program. Roger's steady eye contact with the camera mimics the face-to-face interactions that signal belonging and worth. His donning of a sweater at the start of each episode recalls the soft cloth-covered surrogate preferred by Harlow's rhesus monkeys. In fact, the boxes of vulnerable, sometimes heartbreaking correspondence in the Fred Rogers archive suggest that some viewers saw him as exactly that, a surrogate caregiver who couldn't provide food, but who could and did provide comfort for the children who needed it most. Nothing can replace the influence of unconditional love in the life of a child, Rogers said. Children love to belong. They long to belong. The neighborhood normalized this admission. Characters talked openly, if not always eagerly, about their need for human connection. We see this in King Friday's struggle to express his loneliness. It's difficult, he tells his subjects, but he knows that what's mentionable becomes more manageable. Again and again, the neighborhood's characters reap the rewards of admitting their longing to belonging, to belong, gradually nudging viewers in the direction of doing the same. Mr. Rogers wants to lead us into admitting that we all need to be loved, loved not for our accoutrements or appendages, but for ourselves alone, writes author William Guy. Until we can make such an admission, we are fooling ourselves as we search for what we think will be our happiness. Above all, the neighborhood's atmosphere combats the corrosive effects that loneliness and a lack of belonging can have on human self-worth. As Rogers puts it in a speech, I'm proud of you. Does that sound familiar? It seems I say that a good deal in our neighborhood. Well, whether we're a preschooler or young teen, a graduating college senior, or a retired person, we human beings all want to know that we're acceptable, that our being alive somehow makes a difference in the lives of others. We need to know that we're worth being proud of. Indeed, knowing that we matter to someone else, that we belong in the lives of others, may be the key to happy, healthy lives of our own. Study after study has revealed the importance of mattering at every age and every stage of life, from the very beginning to the very end. In 2019, researchers from the University of Washington announced findings from a long-term study of some 800 adults whom they'd followed since elementary school. Throughout the early 1980s, the parents and teachers of one group received a series of lessons designed to help them build stronger bonds with their kids. The parents and teachers of the group received no intervention at all. When researchers compared the two groups more than 30 years later, they couldn't believe what they found. Those whose parents and teachers had been taught to build stronger relationships outperformed their peers on every measure of well-being, physical health, mental health, relationships, income, civic engagement, and more. This held true across gender, race, and class. The most important things we've learned, said one researcher, summing up three decades of study, is to provide opportunities for kids to have positive social involvement. Make sure your kids have the opportunity to engage with you as a parent. Play with them, hold them, don't just sit on your phone when you're with them. When kids feel bonded to you, they're less likely to violate your expectations. And you are likely to be setting them up to have better lives along into the future. The more kids feel that they matter, that someone accepts them just the way they are, the better they tend to do. In Oakland, California, several public schools added an extra class to the school day. Taught by Black male educators and meant specifically for Black boys, these classes affirmed students' identities and boosted their sense of belonging by emphasizing Black history and culture and by providing personalized college and career counseling. More than anything, reported the New York Times upon visiting a class, it is the deep relationships between instructors and students that hold the key to ending the soul-numbing disenfranchisement that so many young men experience at school. Among the boys enrolled, researchers found the dropout rate fell by nearly half. And although the initiative did not include Black girls, their dropout rate fell too, suggesting that a sense of belonging had spilled beyond the classroom. The Oakland Unified School District has since launched similar initiatives for Black girls and other students who've been marginalized by the system. At the college level, programs designed to affirm students' identity and foster a sense of belonging have reduced gender gaps in STEM courses and achievement gaps beyond first and continuing generation college students. Belonging can even help when we're physically ill or psychologically distressed. Being in the presence of people who accept us, scientists say, makes us less susceptible to pain. That's why having someone at our bedside can help us feel better even when we're sick, even if all they're doing is sitting and keeping us company, notes Howard Ross. In speeches, Rogers himself often remembered visiting a friend, the psychoanalyst Helen Ross, at the end of her life. He sat at her bedside, he said, and held her hand in silence. Likewise, knowing that someone is there for us can make our difficult days easier. As Rogers explained, we can sometimes diffuse a person's volatility just by offering one kind word or sentence, such that it's really tough some days, isn't it? It's amazing what can happen when an angry person feels understood and appreciated. The empathy muscle. Despite his royal stature, the flowing robe, the high up perch on his castle balcony, the kingly Roman numerals he affixes to his name, King Friday the 13th has yet to feel like he matters. He's yet to feel like make-believe sees him, like his neighbors know there's a man beneath the crown. If anything, his regal regalia keeps a sense of belonging at bay. Who, after all, would be foolish enough to try to befriend a king? Enter Randy S. Caribou, a 6-foot reindeer with a self-proclaimed love for foolish things. He's starting a make-believe soccer team with Daniel Tiger, he says. At first, he'd called it the Reindeer Tiger Team, but then Prince Tuesday and Anna Platypus had asked to join it too, so he called it the Boy-Girl Reindeer Tiger Team. Then Lady Aberlin and Bob Dog joined, so now it's the Woman-Dog-Boy-Girl Reindeer Tiger Team. Randy explains. Now everyone's ready to play. Everyone, that is, except for King Friday. Before today, the sovereign might simply have outlawed soccer altogether. He might have lashed out at the woman, dog, boy, girl, reindeer, tiger team, couching his anger at being left out in a royal pronouncement. But something had shifted in Friday. After going around the mulberry bush a couple of times, he felt the enormous weight of his loneliness finally begin to lift. The once proud king had been humbled, and he likes it. Would it be possible to place a king on that team? He timidly asks his subjects. You mean you would, King Friday? I was afraid to ask, says Randy. That's the trouble, Friday cries. Everybody's afraid to ask. Kings are human, too. Well, I'm asking you, Randy replied. How about being on our king, woman, dog, boy, girl, reindeer, tiger team? King Friday accepts, and Randy buys jerseys for the team, pink, sleeveless, laughably too large jerseys that show the world that despite their differences, this team chose togetherness. In his book Sapiens, Yuval Noah Harari explains how human beings managed to break the rules of our wiring and form huge, diverse societies far larger than the tight-knit groups in which we'd evolved. The secret, he writes, was probably the appearance of fiction, stories and structures that don't exist in nature, but which served as a shared experience for people from different tribes. Large numbers of strangers, Harari writes, can cooperate successfully by believing in common myths. Whether those myths are expressed by churches, by flags, or by pink oversized jerseys. Myths provide ways of relating to other people across our lines of difference. They do this in part by setting the stage for empathy, the human ability to imagine other people's experiences and to attempt to understand their feelings, thoughts, and point of view. In recent years, it's been touted as the cure for almost everything. There's a lot of talk in this country about the federal deficit, said the senator, said then Senator Barack Obama in a 2006 commencement speech. But I think that we should talk more about our empathy deficit, the ability to put ourselves in someone else's shoes, to see the world through those who are different from us, the child who's hungry, the laid-off steelworker, the immigrant woman cleaning your dorm room. Others have called empathy the key to world peace and a possible solution to climate change. It's been said to make us better teachers, better doctors, better business professionals, and even better athletes. Not only does it drive us to belonging with others, experts says, it also helps us. According to psychologist Michael Borba, or Michelle Borba, the ability to empathize affects our kids' future health, wealth, authentic happiness, relationship satisfaction, and ability to bounce back from adversity. It promotes kindness, pro-social behaviors, and moral courage. And it is an effective antidote to bullying, aggression, prejudice, and racism. Empathy is also a positive predictor of children's reading and math test scores and critical thinking skills, prepares kids for the global world, and gives them a job market boost. For all the hype about empathy, it's a relatively recent concept. The word itself was only coined in 1909. But since then, an explosion of research has helped uncover how empathy works in the brain. In Wired to Connect, author Britt Andreda relates a fascinating study in which scientists watched participants' brains light up when shown a scene from a movie. Afterwards, when asked to explain the scene to others, participants' brains lit up as if they were still watching the film. Even more fascinating, listeners' brains lit up the same way, Andreetta writes. Even though the listeners were simply hearing another person's description, their brains reacted as if they were watching the film themselves. This suggests that to a certain extent, we can share an experience, or at least a facsimile of an experience that we haven't encountered ourselves. Empathy affects some of us more than others. Some people, for example, may experience physical pain when they see someone else get hurt. For a few, empathy can even be debilitating as they struggle to differentiate between their own pain and that of other people. The existence of these extreme empaths have been hotly debated by scientists. On the whole, however, data suggests that Obama was right, that we really are facing an empathy de deficit. Psychologist Sarah Conrath and her colleagues at the University of Michigan found that between 1979 and 2009, empathy levels among college students fell by about 40%. Compared to their analog peers, digital age college students were far less likely to agree with statements like, "I sometimes try to understand my friends better by imagining how things look from their perspective," or "I often have tender, concerned feelings for people less fortunate than I am." The researchers found a similar decline in kindness and volunteerism. Though their analysis stopped short of pinpointing specific causes, Conrath and her colleagues theorized that media saturation and pressure to achieve from overwhelmed and pressure to achieve have overwhelmed today's students, making them feel as if there's simply no time for thinking about, listening to, or trying to understand other people. Today's young people aren't inherently less kind or empathetic than their predecessors, but they are more anxious and stressed out and worn down and scared, and it's difficult to exercise empathy when that's the way you feel. Rogers himself knew this well. In fact, to keep himself grounded, he woke up every morning at 5 a.m. to give himself a couple of hours of unhurried quiet. He spent those early mornings actively exercising empathy. He would read the Bible, pray for others, and then he would think about the coming day, said Maxwell King. He would spend that time envisioning who he was going to see and how he would be fully engaged and thoughtful and considerate and kind with whomever he encountered. Rogers understood that empathy can be developed and strengthened like a muscle. Empathetic ability is a bit like musical ability. Part nature and part nurture, explains Roman Kuznarczyk, author of Empathy, Why It Matters and How to Get It. Some people just seem to be born with innate musical skill. They've got perfect pitch or can pick almost any instrument and play it beautifully. But musicality is also learned. It is best if we start young, yet most people could still learn to play the guitar pretty well at 45, as long as they put in the effort to practice. And that is how it is with empathy. One of the best ways to practice empathy, experts say, is through storytelling. Stories make abstract concepts visceral. They make invisible policies visible. They help us look past our assumptions and see the people behind them, people with pains and joys, motivations and fears. They help us see neighbors instead of others. We watch the neighborhood stories, writes psychologist Susan Lin, because we have come to care about the essence of these characters. We and our children watch because we know them. We recognize ourselves in their complexity. Indeed, storytelling works both ways. By learning the stories of others, we have come to better understand our own. When we strive to see the perspectives of people beyond our immediate tribes, we expand our concerns and see the world and its injustices more clearly. Remember the Saturday Light Brigade from Chapter One, the radio program where kids make podcasts and audio documentaries? The program students interviewed people confronting homelessness, racism, the difficulties of being LGBTQ, and more. As part of their reporting, the young producers speak with experts, community leaders, and people with lived experience, a process that for some kids completely upend their worldview. By the time they put a finished product together, they're thinking about their subjects in ways they never had before, said Larry Berger, the program's founder. They're full of so much empathy. The work changes them, and it changes their peers who hear it. Of course, empathy does not mean we condone or tolerate everybody's beliefs. When we empathize with someone, we simply aim to discern where they're coming from so that we might understand them. It doesn't require us to agree with or even accept the things they say or do. In fact, empathy can be a powerful tool for changing someone's mind because it makes human connection possible, and it's often a sense of connection that persuades a person to change. In one small study published in Child Development, researchers at the National Institute of Mental Health recruited 16 mothers and their roughly 2-year-old children. Over the course of several months, the mothers recorded incidents in which their children caused another child's distress, whether by biting, hitting, or snatching away a toy. The researchers found that the kids who were most likely to make amends when they'd hurt someone were those whose mothers were both intensely nurturing and intensely moral. Those mothers were horrified when their children caused someone pain, and they let their children know it. Look at what you did. Don't you see you hurt Amy? Don't ever pull hair. This sort of reaction was far more effective than calmly dispensed reasoning. But, and this is essential, it only worked in the context of empathetic caregiving in which mothers and children had close relationships that were otherwise warm and which mothers did not attack their children's character. Rogers himself said it best. I think people don't change very much when all they have is a finger pointed at them, he once told a reporter. I think the only way people change is in relation to somebody who loves them. Who is my neighbor? In 1970, psychologists John Darley and Daniel Batson shared the parable of the Good Samaritan with a dozen seminary students in Princeton, New Jersey. In the Gospel of Luke, a lawyer asked Jesus, "Who is my neighbor?" Jesus replied with a story. A certain man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he fell among robbers who had stripped him and beat him and departed, leaving him half dead. By chance, a certain priest was going down that way. When he saw him, he passed by on the other side. In the same way, a Levite also, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a certain Samaritan, as he traveled, came where he was. When he saw him, he was moved with compassion, came to him and bound up his wounds and pouring on oil and wine. He set him on his own animal and brought him to an inn and took care of him. On the next day, when he departed, he took out 2 denarii, gave them to the host, and said to him, "Take care of him. Whatever you spend beyond that, I will repay you when I return." Now, which of these 3 do you think seemed to be a neighbor to him who fell among the robbers? Darley and Matson asked the students to give a 3 to 5 minute sermon on the story to be recorded in another building on campus. Some of the students were told that they could take their time getting there. Others were told that they were already late and should hurry as fast as they could. The route required them to pass through an alley where Darley and Matson had placed an actor, a victim that each student would find slumped in a doorway, coughing and groaning. The researchers watched to see which students helped and to which degree. The results would make the study famous. Among those who'd been told they could take their time, 63% offered the victim help. Among those who've been told to hurry, however, only 10% bothered to stop. A person in a hurry is likely to keep going, Darley and Batson concluded. Ironically, he is likely to keep going even if he is hurrying to speak on the parable of the Good Samaritan, thus inadvertently confirming the point of the parable. Indeed, on several occasions, a seminary student going to give his talk on the parable of the Good Samaritan literally stepped over the victim as he hurried on his way. Did the Princeton seminarians lack empathy? Not necessarily. In post-experiment interviews, some said they'd noticed the victim but hadn't realized he needed help until later, once they'd had time to reflect. In those cases, Darley and Batson theorized the students' empathetic reactions were likely delayed by their hurrying. Like today's overwhelmed college students, the pressure of their circumstances had prevented them from empathizing. Others, though, had clearly felt empathy in real time. They were visibly shaken as they passed the victim in the alley, but they still hadn't offered to help. It's tempting to ascribe this to heartlessness or hypocrisy, and many people have, but in the young minister's minds, they were already helping someone, the researchers themselves. They'd seen the victim and empathized with his plight, but by stopping to offer their help, they felt they'd be letting down the scientist who'd asked for it first. Conflict rather than callousness can explain their failure to stop, Darley and Botson wrote. Empathy, in other words, isn't necessarily enough. What good is empathy to the victim who's left on the street? Empathy on its own doesn't put a roof over the victim's head or take him to a hospital or put him up in an inn. Empathy can even be self-serving. When we pat ourselves on the back for feeling someone's pain, we risk mistaking that feeling for having done something about the problem. Empathy can also reinforce our biases. We don't deploy it equally, and our reasons for empathizing with some over others can be exceedingly petty. Let's say you're a soccer fan and your favorite team is the king, woman, dog, boy, girl, reindeer, tiger team. You just can't get enough of those pink oversized jersey. And let's say you're taking a stroll one day when you see a stranger trip, fall, and injure himself. And deciding whether to help, does it matter what the stranger is wearing? Science suggests that it does. In fact, when researchers at Lancaster University in the United Kingdom studied this exact scenario, using an actor as the injured stranger, they found that soccer fans were far more likely to help someone who supports their favorite team. When 13 fans of the British soccer club Manchester United saw an actor trip and fall, all but one stopped to help when the actor was wearing a Manchester jersey. Meanwhile, among the 10 Manchester fans who witnessed a Liverpool fan get injured, 7 ignored the incident entirely, and among the 12 fans who watched a plainclothes actor slip and fall, only 4 bothered to help. Indeed, despite its reputation as a social panacea, empathy has limitations and pitfalls that we ought to be aware of. Yale psychologist Paul Bloom wrote a whole book about them, one with a rather surprising title of Against Empathy. One reason why being against empathy is so shocking is that people often assume that empathy is an absolute good, he explains. You can never be too rich or too thin or too empathetic. Empathy is unusual in this regard. When it comes to our feelings and capacities, Bloom argues, we tend to be more nuanced. He gives anger as an example. Anger can be constructive, destructive, or both, depending on how it's used. Still, even critics like Bloom concede that some empathy is required for human connection. The Samaritan can't help the victim at all if he doesn't recognize that the victim needs help in the first place. Likewise, if I'm buying a present for my niece, you don't have to be a moral philosopher to appreciate that I should try to get something that she wants, not something that I want, he writes. To make a positive difference, you need some grasp of what's going on in others' minds. That's why some empathy experts want to tweak our oldest, most universal moral directive, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. The golden rule, they argue, is insufficient. We might end up treating people in a way that would suit ourselves, but could be wholly inappropriate from their perspective, writes Roman Kazarnik. Instead, we ought to upgrade to what's been called the platinum rule, which takes other people's feelings, needs, and experiences into account. Do unto others, the platinum rule states, as they would have you do unto them. Life is for service. As Rogers walked with his new friends and his future wife through the campus of Rollins College, he passed an unassuming plaque on a walkway near the quad. The plaque's inscription struck him as so simple yet so profound that it would shape the rest of his years. He copied it down on a tiny slip of paper, put it in his wallet, and carried it with him for decades. Eventually, he hung a photo of the plaque on the wall of his office in Pittsburgh. Life is for service, it read in capital letters, a reminder that above all, we're put on this planet to help each other. People tend to think that Roger's great passion in life was the education of young children, and that certainly was one of his great passions, says Maxwell King. Another was television and television programming. But I think his overarching dominant passion was to be a good person and to be good to other people. He felt that it was the number one job he had in life. Most of us would more or less agree. Nationally, parents say their highest hope for their children is to grow into loving, caring adults who prioritize family and generosity over everything else. Parents and teachers alike say caring for other people is far more important to them than children's intelligence or achievements. On surveys, at least, our priorities seem loud and clear. But according to a 2014 report released by Harvard University's Graduate School of Education, our children hear something else entirely. About 80% of young people say their parents are more concerned about achievement than they are about being loving or caring. A similar proportions say the same is true of their teachers. When asked what would make their parents prouder, getting good grades or being a caring community member, kids were three times more likely to pick the former. According to the researchers who conducted the survey, the message adults convey about achievement and happiness are far more powerful and far more frequent than the ones we convey about caring. For kids, this can be confusing at best and counterproductive at worst. Those under the most pressure to achieve tend to report the lowest levels of empathy, and those whose parents emphasize happiness aren't necessarily happier. The good news is that kids themselves still value caring for others. Of the 10,000 young people surveyed, about two-thirds listed kindness among their top three values. Many described the strong moral codes they developed over time. As one young person wrote, "I feel the purpose should always put others before themselves. Oh, I feel that people should always put others before themselves and focus on contributing something to the world that will improve life for future generations." Young people like this are onto something, scientists say. Not only does service to others benefit the world at large, it also benefits young people themselves, making them less lonely and more likely to find a sense of belonging. It reduces stress and boosts well-being, and it helps them find that all-important sense that they matter. To become loving and caring people, kids first have to know what they're worth, to know that they're worthy of love and care themselves. That's why when Rogers gave speeches, he often helped his audience see exactly that. From the time you were very little, he say, you've had people who have smiled you into smiling, people have talked you into talking, sung you into singing, loved you into loving. Some of them may be here right now, some of them may be far away, some may even be in heaven, but wherever they are, if they've loved you and encouraged you and wanted what was best in life for you, they're right inside yourself. And I feel that you deserve quiet time on this special occasion to devote some thought to them. So let's just take a minute in honor of those who have cared about all of us along the way. One silent minute. Whomever you've been thinking about, imagine how grateful they must be that during your silent times, you remember how important they are to you. It's not the honors and the prizes and the fancy outsides of life which ultimately nourish your souls. It's knowing that we can be trusted, that we never have to fear the truth, that the bedrock of our lives from which we make our choices is very good stuff. Tears were not uncommon by the minute's end. The exercise immersed participants in gratitude and belonging, reinforcing the notion that they too can be loving, caring people. And understanding that notion can be critical. The greatest thing we can do, Rogers likes to say, is let people know that they are loved and capable of loving. The exercise is closely related to a form of meditation called metta, or loving kindness meditation, a Buddhist practice that strengthens the sense of connection among loved ones, acquaintances, and even strangers. In one metta practice, participants call to mind someone who has loved them deeply. They let them themselves feel that person's love, then they imagine themselves reflecting that love back to the world. According to Emma Sipala of Stanford University, loving kindness meditation can increase feelings of happiness while reducing self-focus and turning our attention towards others. It can prepare us, in other words, for service. Valerie Kinloch remembers the people who loved her, who encouraged her, who wanted what was best in life for her. She knows that even today, they're right inside herself. Many years later, and many miles from home, she still lists their names, Miss Kirkland, Miss Ferguson, Miss Smalls, Miss Green, Miss Thompson. It was the presence of these teachers, these Black women teachers, that provided me with an understanding of what can happen if I would only imagine it. if I would only think of it, if I only put myself in someone else's position, even as a kid in elementary school, and have empathy, she says. They help me embrace the idea that you can always become, you can always strive to be. Kinloch followed that idea from a childhood in Charleston, South Carolina, to a life of service that has spanned the country. As an educator, the author of several books about race literacy and service learning, and the dean of the School of Education at the University of Pittsburgh, Kinloch has spent her career building something better for young people, building a kind of learning that, like her own teachers did for her, shows kids that they matter just the way they are. It's something that the education system too often fails to do, says Kinloch, especially for children who look like she does. Kids walk into classrooms and learning spaces excited. They want to learn, they want to make, they want to redesign worlds. And when we, the adults, don't make space for that, we squash all that creativity, she says. We tell them, you can't do these things that you're dreaming about. Now fit this mold and meet these standards. How do we think about possibilities instead? How do we think about the ways that people dream and imagine better futures? Why don't we start by asking, what do you dream about when you never talk about? What would you do if only you could? By starting there, says Kinloch, we can start to build spaces where everyone, kids and parents and families alike, can feel a sense of belonging. We can start to build spaces where everyone's a learner and everyone's a teacher, and where the learning that happens at home and in communities is just as valuable as the learning that happens in school. We can build spaces that look, in other words, a lot like the neighborhood, where humanity and justice go hand in hand, where we're valued for who we are rather than what we do. To that end, Kinloch also co-chairs Remake Learning, the network of schools, libraries, museums, and out-of-school programs in Pittsburgh comprised of the people and organizations we've met throughout this book and many, many others. At its core, the network exists to nudge us closer to the neighborhood, providing the space for desires and dreams on the one hand and tools for turning possibilities into realities on the other. Whether kids are recording interviews at the Saturday Light Brigade, or spinning pottery at the Manchester Craftsmen's Guild, or weaving community at the Global Minds Initiative, they all come to see that in order to learn, we need only stop and listen to ourselves and to one another. It's a lesson Kinloch learned from an early age. What her teachers helped her to see, she says, is that people around her were a series of books that I hadn't been reading. Everything my teachers were trying to teach me was always right in front of me. I didn't have to open a book to read it. I could just sit and listen to the conversations happening on the front porches or at the kitchen tables or even in the hallways at school. And when I realized that, that's when I deeply fell in love with learning. It's also when she fell deeply into herself, the person she'd become as she read about people around her. One memory in particular remains especially vivid. We were in Miss Ferguson's classroom and a kid stood up and said he was sick. And then all of a sudden he just threw up all over the place, Kinloch recalls laughing. Of course, we were all screaming, "It stinks, Miss Ferguson, it stinks." And very calmly, Miss Ferguson said something like, "We're going to get some supplies and we're going to clean it up. We'll make sure it doesn't soak into the carpet. And anyone who feels like they don't have the stomach for it can go to the other side of the room or in the hallway. But I need someone who's willing to help." Kinloch's fourth grade self stayed in the room to clean. "I remember it so clearly," she says. Miss Ferguson looked at me and said, "You are going to be someone who cares for people and who does good in the world. And even today, that's my work. The type of cleaning up that means being willing to show humanity to others. Being willing to go there even when it's nasty and messy. It means not ignoring human suffering. It means working with other people to make the world better. If we want to clean up, we've got to be out there, whatever out there looks like for each of us. That's the work, that's service. Our little buckaroo. Fred Rogers was just out of college, taking his first steps on the path that would lead to the neighborhood. He'd moved to New York City to learn the art and craft of television production by working behind the scenes at NBC Studios. Among the programs he helped produce was The Gabby Hayes Show, a short-lived Western theme program for children. Star-ring George Gabby Hayes is a folksy, bandana-clad cowboy with a whistle in his speech. The program was as much an ad for its sponsor, Quaker Oats, as it was an original program. But one thing in particular caught Roger's eyes. The Gabby Hayes show began and ended just as the neighborhood would some 15 years later, with its star speaking directly into the camera. "Mr. Hayes," Rogers asked the make-believe cowboy, "what do you think about when you look in the camera and know that there are thousands of people looking at you?" Hayes didn't hesitate. "Freddy," he said, "I think of one little buckaroo." That comment stuck with Rogers for the rest of his career. In The Neighborhood, he later wrote, he tried to do the same thing, imagining one television friend as he talked to the camera. His aim, of course, was to do what Hayes had done and what countless others have tried to do since, connecting with children through a screen. In the spring of 2020, when COVID-19 closed schools around the world, the upheaval thrust smartphones, video conferencing, and virtual instruction into the spotlight. The sudden and near total shift to online learning sparked a wave of frustration from kids, families, and educators alike. Forging human connections is difficult enough under ideal circumstances, when kids and adults can gather in classrooms and communities. Take away that face-to-face interaction, and the difficulty grows by magnitudes, especially with younger kids, for whom interpersonal time is essential to learning and development. The outbreak of COVID-19 was a case study in what can happen when human connections are severed. Parents found themselves largely on their own, coping with financial fallout, childcare concerns, and the health of their families. Educators, for the first time, had to rely almost entirely on digital tools, tools that many of their students couldn't afford or acquire. Kids themselves lost the very connections that helped them define and develop themselves as human beings, connections with friends, peers, and the people beyond their homes. It takes a village to raise a child, but what happens when the villagers all stay home? It's hard, there's no getting around it, says Valerie Kinlock. It's even harder when we think about young kids, because for them, it's often being able to smell and hear and touch and experience. But in the absence of being able to see one another face to face, I go back to building relationships, because learning always starts with relationships, and I don't have to be in front of a person to learn how to be in relation with that person. Instead, it helps to do what Gabby Hayes did and what Fred Rogers did, be there for that one little buckaroo on the other side of the screen. It's a message that Fred Rogers impressed upon his staff. When I first met Fred for advice after completing my bachelor's degree in psychology, said Hedda Sharapan, he suggested that I study child development at the graduate level if I wanted to do work in children's television. And what I heard in that was that the important question is not what can I give to children? The important question is what are they bringing to us? We as adults learn so much when we're curious about who children are. What a great opportunity for us to learn from what they're noticing and expressing, things we might never have considered ourselves. This is especially important as kids carry the weight of the world, whether in the form of climate change, racism, a global pandemic, or all of the above and more. Whatever it is that kids are bringing, it's the job of adults to recognize it, to let kids express it if they want to, and to let kids know that their feelings are all right, whatever those feelings might be. When children want us to listen, they're not just saying, I want you to hear my words, says Kinlock. They're saying, I want you to figure out my body movements. I want you to figure out what you think my eyes are saying. I want you to hear what I'm saying in ways where, if for only a minute you suspend your beliefs about me, you suspend the judgments of where you're carrying and the point you want to make, and you just sit back and truly listen. It's by doing this, experts say, that we begin to restore the connections we've lost. It's a slow, sometimes difficult process, one that requires every tool for learning that the neighborhood left us. We have to be curious about kids. We have to let them be creative in the way they reveal themselves to us. We have to listen to them deeply and talk to them lovingly. And we have to show up for them as if we want them to show up for us. Whether we're talking through a computer or face-to-face, says Kinlock, if we don't have a connection with students, I'm not going anywhere. Fortunately for us, connection doesn't require that we always have the answers. On the contrary, revealing our own vulnerability, our fears, our self-doubts, our uncertainty, models for kids that it's okay to not know that we need one another, or it's okay to not know and that it's good to ask for help. It models for kids that it's okay to admit that we need one another. In times of stress, says Rogers, the best thing we can do for each other is to listen with our ears and our hearts and to be assured that our questions are just as important as our answers. It's those questions and in that listening that human connection can thrive, whether we're kids, adults, or make-believe kings. Welcome, King Friday exclaims, donning the jersey that covers his robe. Team members, I presume. Correct as usual, King Friday, his teammates shout at one. From the castle balcony, make-believe's rulers waves at to his subjects. No, he waves to his friends. He waves to those caring people and puppets who've shown him that he, King Friday the 13th, matters, that he's part of something special. That even though he's been brash and volatile and insecure, and even though he might be those things again, he can still find grace and connection with others. He can still do what he's been put here to do, serve his beloved community. The team's all here. They've even added a few new players. With Henrietta Pussycat and X the Owl on board, the Pussycat Owl King Woman Dog, boy, girl, reindeer, tiger team is finally ready to play. Whether the game is soccer or hide and seek or dancing around the mulberry bush, it makes no difference to the jubilant king. It just feels nice to be part of a team. Every time we get together in our outfits, King Friday tells his pink-jerseyed friends, we can decide that we'll play and we'll play it. And we'll win the game of having fun. Let's hear it for our team. Back in his living room, Mr. Rogers waits for us, like always. He looks much happier now that Friday has found a team, and he hopes that we can find one too. And no matter what game you play, he tells us, you can be yourself, and that's all you'll ever have to be. You are you, and that's enough for anybody, and knowing that can give you such a good feeling. Mr. Rogers smiles. He felt that feeling himself. He thinks, perhaps, about his team, about his parents and his grandparents, about the car full of friends on a tarmac in Florida, about his wife, Joanne, and his mentor, Margaret, for whom he wrote this episode. Perhaps he thinks of all the people who have smiled him into smiling, talked him into talking, and sung him into singing. Or perhaps he thinks just for a moment of Helen Ross, the friend he'd visited at the end of her life. It was Helen, after all, who had liked to remind him, don't forget the fun. It was Helen who had spent a lifetime studying the wonders of human development. And it was Helen who, during Roger's final bedside visit, revealed what she had learned. I found Helen very frail, Rogers recalled. Some of the time I just held her hand and we said nothing. We didn't have to. After one of those silences, Helen said to me, do you ever pray for people, Fred? Of course I do, I said simply. Dear God, encircle us with thy love wherever we may be. And Helen replied, that's what it is, isn't it? It's love. That's what it's all about. What might you do? Have you ever felt like you didn't belong? Each of us has, at some point, felt isolated. We clearly weren't wanted on the team, or our peers wanted to reject us. Talk to children about why it hurts when you feel like you don't belong and how they might seek ways to build bridges beyond their friends. Who else could be on their team? Who might feel excluded? Encourage your child to ask the quiet kid across the street to play, or ask your child to point a picture or to paint a picture for their neighbor who's stuck inside. How can kids say in their own way, I have always wanted to have a neighbor just like you? King Friday and Bob Dog learned that they were more alike than they might have assumed. While they've been separated materially by King Friday's regal clothes and high perch, they found that they shared an experience they'd both been left out. They connected with each other by coming to and understanding the other character's perspective. Talk with your kids about their friends and neighbors. What unexpected experiences, feelings, and beliefs might they share? What might they gain by learning about others' lives and imagining themselves in other people's shoes? Empathy, like doing a cartwheel or drawing a really good circle, is something that has to be practiced. Help your kids to identify small things that they can do to put themselves in other people's positions. On their birthday, Greg's kids receive lots of gifts. Each year, however, they're only allowed to keep three or four of them. The rest are set aside for a charitable organization called Beverly's Birthdays, which arranges birthday parties for kids experiencing homelessness. The conversations that ensue help children understand why some of their peers don't receive gifts, why some kids have homes, and why it's good to share with others. Is there something relatable you can do with your own kids to help them build their empathy muscles? Allow yourself to be vulnerable with your children. Adults say, Valerie Kinlock, have to be vulnerable and willing to show that we're human beings who have feelings and who don't have all the answers. When we can show that to kids, they will always show it to us. Be honest when you don't know the answer to something and invite your children along on the quest to discover the answer. Be willing to give your children and yourself a break when things get overwhelming. Some days, said Rogers, doing the best we can may still fall short of what we would like to be able to do, but life isn't perfect on any front, and doing what we can with what we have is the most important. Have is the most we should expect of ourselves or anyone else.